So for a person to be able to describe his experience and not what he believes he's doing or what he imagines he's doing, he has to enter into close contact with it. And the first condition for such a description is that it must be about a singular experience. If you want to help the interviewee to convert his attention from the what to the how and to become aware of the pre-reflexive part of his experience, it's essential to help him to shift from a general description to a description, to the description of a particular situation, which is precisely situated in time and space. No one has an experience in general. A lived experience is necessarily single. So the choice of a singular experience is an essential stage in the interview. If the experience which is explored is easily reproducible, the researcher could devise a protocol enabling the interviewee. Michel, is not there? Michel Ferrari?
No, he left yesterday.
So the researcher could devise a protocol enabling the interviewee to carry out the process here and now, and then just afterwards help the person to describe his experience. It was the case for the matrix of figures, for example. If the experience being studied cannot be reproduced at will, for example, wisdom, the researcher must help the interviewee to find in the past a particular occurrence of this experience. This is what I did in my research on intuitive experience, enabling the interviewed person to find the exact moment of the new ideas emergence of the therapeutic insight, for example. If, moreover, the process being studied has lasted for several hours or several days, one or several specific moments must be selected on which the elicitation process will concentrate. The singular character of the experience is thus an essential condition for somebody to be able to come into contact with his experience. But there is an additional difficulty. Most of the time, there is a temporal gap between the experience and its description. So, to come into contact with one's experience, one has to recall it, to replay it. It is this aspect of the interview technique that we are going to explore in this session, this morning. Even if in the most favorable case, that is, if the experience can be reproduced at will, it is usually impossible to describe it as it is taking place, for several reasons. First, because of the rapidity of the process. For example, when I spell a word or when I memorize a matrix of figures, the operations are so numerous and so rapid that it's impossible, even with intensive training, to observe them at the very instant I am performing them. I think it's the same thing for a very manual task as the task we had yesterday night with the clay. A lot of operations, internal operations. In order to become conscious of the carrying out of process and describe it, I must reenact it, play it out again in an inner way. I must in fact reenact it several times, because the first time I can only identify the main phases of the process. I must reenact each of these phases in turn in order to describe them in the form of a set of sub-phases, which I must in turn reenact to access at a level of greater detail. and so on. The complexity of the process also plays a role, because it's impossible for me to focus my attention on all the dimensions of the process at once: the visual, the auditory, the kinesthetic, the emotional dimensions at once. I must reenact the process in an inner way several times, focusing my attention each time on a different dimension. But the main reason is that it seems impossible for us to direct our attention at the same time onto the what and the how, onto the content and the structure of experience. For example, the content of an image, an internal image, and its structure constitute two different attention contents, which require two different modes of attention, two different attention positions. And finally, even if an experience can be described in real time, for example, a bodily sensation which lasts a long time, it seems that experience and its description are not concomitant. The attentive observation of the description process shows that it is in fact an alternation of instants in which the subject silently comes into contact with his experience, and of times in which he describes the trace, the internal imprint left in him by the experience. In all these cases, the subject has to make something special for coming into contact with his experience and describing it. He has to recall it, to refresh it. Whether the experience being described is present, just past or past, this coming into contact is a very specific internal gesture, which may be achieved in a more or less efficient way. When the subject describes his experience while being in close contact with it, we say that he has an embodied utterance position.
Can you say that again? He has
an embodied utterance position.
Utterance.
In French, we say position de parole incarnée. Bon, c'est
position de parole incarnée.
But embodied is nice of incarnée.
Speak.
Embodied speech position. Would it be okay? Embodied speech position?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. So this position is very specific and very different from an abstract utterance position, where the subject is not in contact with his experience, but instead describes a vague memory of his experience, or representations, judgments, or beliefs about his experience. In the explicitation method, we consider essential that the interviewer helps the subject to achieve this refreshing of experience. And when a person achieves this gesture, she enters a specific internal state that we call the evocation state. Now I would like to invite you to participate in a little experiment. And for this, I would like you to settle yourself as comfortably as possible and to close your eyes. Now, imagine that you are at home and that you are walking towards your kitchen. Imagine that you are coming into your kitchen. Look around you at everything that is in the kitchen: the furniture, the utensils. The specific light of your kitchen. in this place there may be particular sounds. There may also be particular smells. Let these sounds and these smells come back to you. Go back in your kitchen as if you were there. Now you are working toward your kitchen table. On this table there is a lemon. Take this lemon in your hand and examine it attentively. Look at the particular color of this lemon, its form. Feel the particular texture of the lemon skin in your hand. Now, you put back the lemon on the table, and while holding it with one hand, you take a knife in the other hand. And then, slowly, taking your time, cut the lemon in two parts. Listen to the little noise, the particular crunch of the knife cutting the skin of the lemon. Feel the specific sensation that you have in your hands. Now, look at the two halves of the lemon. You may see some pips appearing on the pulp of the lemon. You may see some lemon juice on the table. Now, slowly, take one of the two halves of the lemon and raise it to your face. You're probably beginning to smell the particular odor of the lemon. And now you raise it to your mouth and you bite into the pulp. You take a bit of it and you slowly chew it. You feel the lemon juice running in your mouth, and then you swallow the bit of lemon. Okay. Now, imagine a little different story. Imagine that you are seated in a chair at the cinema, and that on the screen you're watching yourself at home, walking toward your kitchen. You watch yourself coming into your kitchen, amidst the furniture and the utensils of your kitchen. Still on this cinema screen, you see yourself walking toward your kitchen table, taking a lemon from the table and examining this lemon attentively. Then you see yourself putting the lemon on the table, taking a knife and cutting the lemon in two parts. Still on your cinema armchair, you watch yourself raising one of the two halves to your mouth, biting into it, chewing it, and swallowing it. Now you can come back where we are now and open your eyes. So, why do you think I proposed you this exercise, and what was the difference between the two experiences I proposed you? Was there a difference?
Well, I could taste the lemon. I could feel my mouth watering quite significantly in the first part of the exercise.
I saw it.
yeah, almost drooling.
But it was not too bad.
So it was very rich sensorially, the first part of it. I'll just make a side comment here. When I do these kinds of exercises, I always find it difficult to either identify or stay stable when I'm imagining myself in a particular situation. Sometimes I feel this body here moving through the space. Other times I see an image of myself moving through the space. I seem to flip back and forth between the two. But even so, I can, but it doesn't always happen at will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But this time, the juxtaposition of the second part of the exercise with that first part, where I found myself seeing myself walking down the hall and into the kitchen and from the kitchen mm-hmm. to the table, that had a very different quality than sitting in a cinema seat watching myself on the screen doing that. Mm-hmm. It certainly felt much more third person,
mm-hmm.
More distant. And I didn't have hardly any, if any, of the reactions watching myself on screen cut the lemon and bite into the lemon.
Mm.
And at the end I realized that it really made little difference that the person on the screen walking to the table and cutting the lemon was me. It could have been anybody else. It made no difference that it was me. So I didn't have any... This body did not have any identification, really, with the person on the screen going through those actions.
Thank you very much.
Yes. I think, first of all, it was a very interesting example for me. And, of course, there's an enormous difference between the first part and the second part.
Mm.
To put it in the most straightforward terms, I think in the first part we are like subject to what's happening, whereas in the second part we are more like object. Suddenly perceive ourselves from a quasi third person perspective, observing ourselves out there. But in the first part, we are right within what we say.
Yeah.
And I would put it perhaps in terms of the other senses and the visual sense. That the second part was entirely visual. I felt kind of the other sensory.
And the perspective is different as well, because when you're in it, you're seeing things from inside the 3D space, whereas you have only got the 2D projection. If you're looking at the whole thing happening from the outside,
just a couple of comments, Claire.
Yeah.
In the time scale of the two episodes were different. The first one was actually slower than real time, and I kept running ahead of you.
Yes.
And then having to slow myself down in order to keep in time with the pace of the narrative, as it were. And the second one was pretty well natural time, but it ran much faster. And I wondered whether if you'd done it the other way around, it might have been different. And also, if you've just done a repeat of the kitchen, of being really in the kitchen, instead of a cinema viewing of the episode a second time, whether the second one would have had maybe some of the remoteness that people are reporting about the cinema episode, because it was a repeat of something rather than just a fresh.
Tu peux me dire.
Oui, en fait, le deuxième point, oui, c'est intéressant, c'est que il se demande si le fait d'avoir redit la même chose mais d'un autre point de vue n'a pas, par le fait même de la répétition, diminué la fraîcheur de la deuxième expérience. Le fait de la répétition est pas seulement le changement de point de vue.
Usually, I think it's the contrary. And I think you are going to experience that later in this morning. if you repeat, it's the contrary. It must have been more intense.
The image, the second is more.
No, if you, it's not a question of repeating it. Mm. If you repeat the first one, mm-hmm. if you had repeated the first one, it would have been more intense mm-hmm. the second time. Mm.
So
I would like you to test that. I think mm-hmm. we can do it.
I was going to mention just a couple of small things, actually. The second time, it was pretty much a repeat, but when when I picked up the knife, it was a better knife. It was better suited to the task of cutting the lemon than the first time. It was a different knife.
But you didn't pick up, you saw yourself.
Yes, the one who picked up, right. The one I saw had a better knife in his hand, and it was easier to cut the lemon with that knife.
I'm not happy for you.
And the second thing is just because you set it up as cinema, because of the way my kitchen is set up, I actually kind of worried about the camera angle.
So did I, and I lost continuity in the second, because I was worried about how this could happen, how this could operate.
I just ignored your instructions at that point, because we have an oak kitchen table. I wouldn't dream of cutting a lemon on it.
At first, I was just behind the screen, on the screen, I was behind myself in the figure. Then I had to figure out how to get around in order to see what was really happening. So I became aware of the power of cinema in a whole different way than I ever had. So how do you communicate this? Where do you have to be?
Yeah.
The choice is made.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is this what I found?
Thank you. Thank you. So, as you have guessed, the objective of this exercise was to make you experience two very different perceptual positions in an imaginary scene. In the first case, the subject lives the scene as himself or herself. He has a first-person personal position, perceptual position, first-person perceptual position. We say more simply that he is associated with the scene. In the second case, the subject has a third person perceptual position, and we say that he is dissociated from the scene. And this exercise is intended to show that the bodily sensations and are more precise and intense when the subject is associated with the scene than when he is dissociated. I was hesitating to skip an exercise, but I think your question tells me that it is important to do it. So I would like to invite you to participate in another little exercise. I would like it to be very, very short. This exercise consists of identifying a number of past situations. I'm going to give you this tableau. So you have to identify a number of personal of pleasant and unpleasant situations in personal context and professional context. These situations must qu'est-ce qu'il y a?
We talked a lot about that.
These situations must correspond to very precise and short moments situated in space and time. Each time you identify a situation, give it a title. For example, walk in the forest to the ocean, or my last discussion with my boss. Just it could be one word for identifying the situation. And these titles have to be written clearly enough to be read by somebody else. But you won't have to describe these situations to anybody else. So I give you the you have 5 minutes for doing the exercise.
Would it help our hinder if you tell us now what the point of this exercise is?
No.
Do you want three of each or just one?
Claire, what are the other boxes for?
Yes, but if you don't fill all the box, it doesn't matter. Just
at least one.
Yes, at least one in each.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Even if it's not finished, how many?
No, please don't look.
No, I don't. I need
another time.
Not 5 minutes.
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Oh, I'm sorry. It doesn't matter if you have only two or three situations. It doesn't matter at all. It's not a problem.
I'm sure you have an unpleasant
situation.
Yes, she's got one.
I'm pressured by as the answer was
after. Is that personal or?
Well, it's you. Just you.
It doesn't matter.
Thank you.
So,
the pleasant is getting an additional 3 minutes to.
I just meant to ask for one for longer.
Okay.
How many situations do you have?
There's no
you don't want to tell me.
No, I found three for personal conduct, pleasant one, and the unpleasant one Michelle just gave me.
So it's okay. Perfect. So you have only one unpleasant.
And then it's the same in both professional and personal.
Well, here's one for the unpleasant. Failing miserably at this little exercise.
I don't know if I just don't think. I think there are too many good things. And it's hard to choose them.
And
the bad things are much longer ago in my past, and I don't really like to think about them. So I find it hard to do it.
So, now I would like you to work with your neighbor. So you are going to help your partner to complete this saving, and then your partner will help to complete yours. So to help your partner to complete this saving, take his saving and choose a title randomly on the table. Say it. And ask your partner to evoke the corresponding situation, to think about the corresponding situation.
Internally. Now? Not loud.
No?
No. I am explaining the exercise. After that, you do it.
You go silent.
Silent. Just evoking. Very briefly. Just think about it. Very quickly. Think about this thing. And then ask him if he has evoked the scene in an associated position or a dissociated position. Okay? It is the goal of the case. I had that you may have to create, so just write associated, dissociated, but you may have to create a new column.
A new column,
because sometimes it is both associated, or mm-hmm. first associated and then dissociated, or maybe something completely different, a new, maybe you have the chance to discover a completely new attention position.
So do you want to go a number of times,
associated, dissociated? No. You write associated, dissociated, and for example, maybe a new thing. Mm-hmm. Just make a cross.
Right.
Just make cross. It's very simple. You have just to make crosses. And do the same for each situation, randomly. It's better to do it randomly.
But one person at a time, I'm not switching back and forth.
Yes, you feel the whole table for Mark, and after.
Do you have to describe the situation to
you? Not at all. You don't say anything. Just put the. Completely.
So you tell me whether it was.
Inside the associated state.
How such?
Inside the intensity of the associated.
Yeah.
Where is Tom?
We can say.
No, because he must understand what I'm going to explain.
Well, that's real.
Do we swap back? Yes, you keep. Now you can take yours.
Okay, so everybody goes back to their own.
I'll just take my first piece.
Okay. No! Oh, I see, I moved up. Yes, I did. Ah, yes, I did. No, I did. The objective of this exercise was to lead you to experience what the state of evocation is and to show you that this state is, in fact, very familiar to all of you. The evocation state corresponds to the particular case where you are associated with a past scene. In other words, when you recall a past scene while being associated with it. Frequently, we recall pleasant scenes while being associated with them and unpleasant scenes while being dissociated with them. But it's not always the case. You understand why, because the sensations are weaker in the dissociated state.
Yes.
We could spend a lot of time on the analysis of this exercise, but I used it.
And then we'd all be healed and go home feeling whole.
No. But in fact, I use the exercise only in this for this purpose to make you experience what is the evocation state. But I may add that the technique. Of association and dissociation is often used in therapies. For example, in therapy of traumatism, it consists of teaching a person who replays again and again a traumatic scene to progressively become dissociated from the scene. And there are a lot of users of this two different perceptual positions in therapy. But in the explicitation session, the interview leads the person to enter an evocation state, because only this state will enable the interviewed person to come sufficiently into contact with the experience so as to become aware of all its dimensions and describe them. The evocation state corresponds first within a type of memory which has been called concrete memory, for example by the French psychologists Ribot and Gusdorf, and more recently episodic memory or autobiographical memory. This type of memory has been contrasted with intellectual memory. Intellectual memory being the type of memory you use, for example, when you are asked to memorize a matrix of figures or a list of nouns. Intellectual memory, on which most experimental research focuses, is voluntary, intentional, based on the project to remember. It's a type of memory you used yesterday. On the contrary, concrete memory. In concrete memory, the experience is memorized without any intention of memorizing. Mm-hmm. For example, all these situations that you have remembered, you didn't have the project to remember them.
You're talking about memorizing or recalling.
Memorizing.
So when the memory was being laid down.
Yeah, you. Okay.
No, she didn't mean that. Oh, I think she meant the opposite. When recalling, it just came.
No, for the moment, I'm speaking of memorizing.
Yes. But I see what you're saying. No. You're talking about the learning process.
No.
But that never is the case. You never choose to record them. It's only when you learn something that
Claire was saying you don't choose to record.
I won't get technical.
Yesterday, you voluntarily chose to memorize the matrix.
Now that's what I understand.
But these situations, you didn't.
When you're learning it and memorizing it, that's fine. Or just different languages.
Okay, sorry. So. In concrete memory, the memorizing process is involuntary, but the recalling process is also involuntary. It doesn't occur on the initiative of discursive thought, but spontaneously, usually through the intermediary of a sensorial trigger. Thus, the memory cannot be deliberately set off, but it's possible to prepare for its emergence by rediscovering the sensations linked to the experience.
Claire, can you give an example of a voluntary, something that is within discursive, under the control of discursive thought? Because it seems to me nothing is.
Recall. Are you asking the question for the process of recalling or memorizing?
Or anything, more generally. Any example. I mean, it seems to me that if I want to remember something, I decide I want to remember it, but then the remembering is not under my control. Either I do or I don't. It just comes up or doesn't.
For the memorizing, I think there is
a voluntary.
To memorize, for example, yesterday you made something special in order to memorize.
Okay.
For the recalling process, in fact, I'm not so sure that you, if you recall, for example, a date in history, for example, a date, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it is a discursive process. I'm not sure that it's so different from concrete memory.
Right.
I'm not sure. Okay, that's okay. It's okay. We can explore that, this question. But yes.
I mean, I feel, you know, just thinking about my own phenomenology,
mm-hmm.
There are some memories where I do, you know, make an effort and gradually build up in my head the scene of the past memory.
Yeah.
So it is, you know, it can be voluntary, but sometimes, as you say, it isn't. The recalling is sometimes under voluntary control, and sometimes it just happens.
Yes, I would like to give an example. Because
it has a mix of that, but I would imagine if you were sitting down to write your autobiography, there's a large element of voluntary recall involved in that. But you don't have total control over it, because some memories will arise and others won't.
Max is looking as though
there's a library of research. No, it's fine. I mean, obviously, there's a whole literature associated with it. But I understand what Karen's saying.
I would like to give an example of recalling a memory of the because you do something,
yeah.
But in fact, it's indirect. You don't access directly the memory. You have to do it, but you do something trigger the memory. So I just give you this example. If I asked you, what is the first thought you had when you woke up this morning?
Turkey.
if you really want that answer. Yes, maybe, but if you really, for doing that, of anyway, if you really want to answer me, you probably have no way for recovering this memory other that return in thought in your bed at the moment where you awoke. Therefore, the trigger may be visual. That is, in order to remember the experience, you recall the visual context of the experience, your bedroom, what you saw when you wake up. The trigger may be auditory. You recall the sounds,
yes.
Such as the bird singing or the alarm clock going off. It may be kinesthetic. You recall, for example, the position of your body in the bed. It may be also olfactory or gustative, as in Proust's well-known Madeleine. So therefore, to guide the subject in the context of an interview, to guide the subject toward the evocation of the experience to be described, even if this experience has just occurred, the interviewer helps him to rediscover precisely the spatial temporal context of the experience, when, where, with whom, and then with precision the visual, auditory, tactile and kinesthetic, olfactory and possibly gustatory sensation associated with the experience, until the past situation is re-enacted to the point that it is more present than the interview situation. So, for inducing, triggering this evocation state, you have to ask visual question. Usually, this order is better, but it can be another order. But usually it's easier to recall the visual context first. So when you were there, so first you have to identify a precise moment. When and identify and say when was there and where was there. Time and space. Yes.
I say if you're but that won't always be the same. It won't always be the same order. If you're remembering an auditory experience, for example, the visual.
The goal is to explicitate a situation, the unfolding of your experience during a moment.
Yeah.
So, you have first to identify precisely this moment and recall and help the person to come back to this moment. For example, if I wanted to explicitate my experience when I was yesterday night with the clay so it is a very specific moment. It was yesterday night at 9 and in the dining room. So it's a very situated moment. It's very essential that the moment is very well situated. And then it's very difficult for me to remember my experience, what was my experience, even now, one day after. So I would like the interviewer to ask me, so come back to this stretcher, to this situation, see again, find again what was around you. But I was blind, but so the visual doesn't it's
but in that case, the visual isn't primary, the kinesthetic might be primary, or the auditory.
Yes, but anyway, you have to, if you make a research on auditory sensations, for example, or for tactile sensations, and it is your goal, and you don't care about the rest of the other sensations, you have to help the person to relive the experience, the whole experience with all the sensations, and then you focus on what you want, what you interest you, or what interests the other person, or anyway. Any explicitation interview has to begin with the recalling of the whole context, in order for the person to come rentrer dans sa peau à nouveau,
to
reintegrate his skin of the moment, to really adopt the first person perceptual position of this past moment, an associated state. So the question must be very precise, but not inductive. So just when you were there, what were you seeing? I would like you to describe this place to me as you saw it at this time. Look around you again at what you were seeing. So there is it must be very soft, because the person is entering a special state, and he has to progressively, as you said, Steve, recall all the dimensions. It's progressive. All doesn't come at once. So, and in this place, there may be sounds. At this moment, what were you hearing? Find again the sounds, the noises, the conversations, or the silence, because you have to be as open as possible. Because if you ask a question, not adapted question, it makes the person go out of the evocation state immediately. So it's very delicate. Listen again to everything you are hearing. and transition while continuing to see everything you are seeing and to hear everything you are listening to. Let the sensations come back. At that time, what was the position of your body? At that time, what were you feeling? Recall the bodily sensations, the emotions eventually. So,
well, not necessarily emotionally, maybe there they predominate, they're more immediate than all the detail, all the sensorial details.
Yes, but you usually the explicitation interview is not used for doing therapy. It could be, but so you don't have usually you don't explore only an emotional process.
No, what I was I wasn't saying that that's the primary goal of the, but I was saying that some that when you're remembering an event,
yes, I understand.
The effective tone of the event maybe what is comes back more quickly.
Yes, you're right. But nevertheless, you have to have the person recall the all the. If it was for a therapy, it would be sufficient to have this emotion and then work with the emotion. But in an explicitation interview, you have to recall, you have to let all the experience, the whole experience, come back.
But I want to agree with Steve for a moment. Let me give a kind of funny example. When I was in high school, I remember in learning trigonometry, and you learn about sines and cosines and those things. I don't remember. I do remember, and at the time, the way I remembered them, the way I remembered which one was which, by which one I liked the most. Mm-hmm. That was my I was very fond of tangents.
Mm.
And so when I was trying to remember what a tangent was or something like that, then I would think about which one I liked the most. Mm. So if you said
cosine,
I hated cosine. Yeah. So it seems to me that sometimes in a situation, if you said, well, remember the situation, the way I would get back into it the most easily would be to say, what were you feeling? What was your kind of emotional, the affect of the situation? And then I would be there, and then I could fill in the other details.
Mm. Maybe.
An
emotional or
affective people.
Trigger in spite of Madeleine.
Okay.
Is it a sort of reliving?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, a set of subjective and objective criteria for checking the intensity of the state of evocation have been identified. The objective indicators are the best known.
I wonder about Kobabel. I'm sorry, I was just thinking of Kobabel.
Yes, I explain that. Yes. There are verbal, non-verbal, and paraverbal indicators. The verbal indicators are the use of the word I. When the person is really reliving, he doesn't say we or us or en français le verbe on en anglais
one.
It's I, because it is really. So it is a very important indicator that the present tense, in fact, very quickly, the person begins to use the present tense, because she is reliving the experience. And you as interviewer have to immediately use also the present tense in your questions. Because if he begins to speak with present, and you ask the question using past, it's a very bad way. It's a very good way to make him go out of the evocation state. So, the indicators are also specific context indicators of place and time, and the concrete and detailed character of the vocabulary which used. If the person uses abstract terms, it's not a good sign. It's a sign that he is more or less reciting some theoretical knowledge. An example of a nonverbal indicator is the direction of the eyes when the subject is in the evocation state. He takes his eyes off the interviewer to look into space, to the horizon. It's a very good indicator. The person doesn't look at you anymore. She looks somewhere in the space. At the same time, the flow of speech slows down, and the words are often cut with silences. And these paraverbal clues are the sign that the subject is coming into contact with the pre-reflexive dimension of his experience, which is not easily accessible, and it takes time, so the person slows down, they are silent. And at the same time, co-verbal, just the gesture, will appear often, because the person, in fact, these gestures are usually unconscious, and they occur even with blind people. In fact, they do not seem to be intended to transmit information to the interviewer, but rather they occur because the subject is in contact or attempting to make contact to his distant past or recent past experience. So, although subjective criteria have not been, although the subjective, not objective, but subjective criteria of this evocation state have not been extensively researched or not at all, if the person who, if you ask the person who has just evoked the situation to evaluate the degree of intensity of this evocation on a scale from 1 to 10, he or she knows very well how to answer, usually. This proves that the person has some very implicit criteria. And one of my projects is to study these internal criteria more precisely. But it's difficult. And so it is only when, thanks to these clues, all these clues, the interviewer observes that the evocation state is sufficiently intense and stabilized, that he can enable the interviewee, with the help of appropriate questioning, to turn his attention towards his inner processes and describe them. So, what I mean is that the evocation state is a precondition for the explicitation process. It's a precondition. And in fact, we always begin the explicitation process with une mise en évocation, with triggering the evocation state. And during the whole, afterwards, during the whole explicitation session, we verify that the person is actually always in the evocation state, that he or she stays in this state during the whole explicitation session. So we have some techniques to refresh the evocation state when the person go out, and it often occurs that he or she go out of this state. So we have, but I explain that to you afterwards. Maybe we could have a pause, and just afterwards I will propose you an exercise of evocation. How you are going to help your partner to enter into an evocation state. Okay? The evocation state of a very nice memory. is it?
Short break?
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. 11:03, 11:20.
Okay. I would like you to invite you to another exercise using the evocation state and the question for describing the diachronic and synchronic dimension. This exercise is called scale because the goal is to to deepen the scale of description. I don't know if you say that in English. So I think with the exercise you are going to work back two by two.
Does that mean two? Just groups of two?
Groups of two, yeah. Okay. Two by two.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Two by two.
Two by two. And
that sounds like two groups of two.
the interview should first you as an interviewer you should help the interviewee to identify a skill or an activity she or he likes, and then helps him to recall a precise moment when he has performed this activity or used this skill. It may be yesterday or 1 week ago, 1 month ago, 1 year ago. But the moment must be very precise. And then you have to help the person to evoke the situation. So exactly, you begin exactly as you have just done. When was it? Where was it? And help him to recall the visual, auditory, kinesthetic context of the situation until he really enter the situation, refresh the situation, and then help him or her to describe the unfolding of the experience while being in this evocation state under the form of a succession of phases. So exactly what I proposed you to do for the exercise of the matrix. But now it's very different. It is a situation completely different. So a succession of phases. And then I propose you to choose one of these phases and to deepen. So if I understand, there was phase one, phase two, phase three. Let's return to phase two.
In time. Phases in time?
Yes, in time. Mm-hmm. And then deepen the description progressively at each level, choosing a phase or sub-phase, and try to get a description to go as far a level of description as fine as possible. Maybe the challenge could be I would like to see where I can go, in terms of precision. How precise can be the description? Mm-hmm. Could be the goal, because in half an hour you can explore all the experience. Even if this experience of using this skill is very brief, that is not always the case. But even if it's very brief, you can explore everything. So I propose you to focus and focus and focus. And maybe when you meet together, come back with a bit of description, very fine, in order to show the others until where you have gone.
How far we were able to go.
Yes, yes, thank you, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So the phases.
Yeah.
The scale is connected with the phases.
So no. In fact, I'm sorry. This is not this scale.
That was really
that is it's completely different. No. This scale is the degree of intensity of evocation. It's a
scale.
Yeah. It's the previous scale. It's a mirror.
Drilling down to the subphases.
This is what you meant by scale. We just there is a procedure, the thing that he is doing, and we'll try to break it into phases,
mm-hmm.
and then we go into those phases as close as possible.
Yes, so phases. You choose one, and you connect the description of the phases.
So it is the description of actions, what he does, because this is a skill. Or also emotion, everything.
No, everything. Everything. Mm-hmm. You and for the precise before, it's not especially the skill, but the whole experience. Mm-hmm. It's not maybe
yes.
Everything.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.